Judge and Mrs. Breyer, welcome. We're delighted to have you here.
In July 1994, then-Senator Joe Biden led the confirmation hearings of 55-year-old Stephen Breyer, a judge on the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, who President Bill Clinton had tapped to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court.
At the outset, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank this committee, really, for the serious attention that you all have paid to my nomination.
Yesterday, Justice Stephen Breyer officially announced that he will be retiring at the end of the current Supreme Court term. Nearly 28 years since he presided over those confirmation hearings, President Biden spoke of how Justice Breyer's time on the bench would be remembered.
His legacy includes his work as a leading scholar and jurist in administrative law, bringing his brilliance to bear to make government run more efficiently and effectively. It includes his stature as a beacon of wisdom on our Constitution and what it means. And through it all, Justice Breyer has worked tirelessly to give faith to the notion that the law exists to help the people.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, Stephen Breyer's legacy, the state of the Supreme Court, and the impact his replacement could have. With us now is David Savage. He's a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. David, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly.
So I just want to start off with, at the top, with your overall takes about Stephen Breyer as he announces his retirement. What do you think his legacy will be on the court?
Well, I was interested that the clip of him in 1994, because when I've been thinking about Justice Breyer, he seems like a figure from a different time. In 1994, he was coming on a court. Bill Clinton was trying to pick. He'd picked Ruth Ginsburg the year before, then Stephen Breyer. And the idea was this was a conservative-leaning court, but there were several moderates, Sandra O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy. And Justice Breyer had the view then, had it in his entire career, that he could work with the moderate justices to sort of find middle ground or common sense sort of middle positions. The court was not frozen. And the idea that Justice Breyer is a very optimistic guy. He always thinks if we can, you know, sit down and talk together, we can work out some reasonable deal, some practical deal. And that's the way he was on the court for 27 years, always trying where he could to try to find some middle ground. But this is a very different, the new justice, she will be coming on a court that where there's a 6-3 conservative majority, and there really isn't any moderate in the middle who could work with a liberal justice. So I'm struck by the Breyer approach to the court sort of made a certain amount of sense in the 1990s and beyond. And he had a record of, you know, a fair number of issues where, particularly when Sandra O'Connor was there, of being able to work together and work the middle. But those days, I think, are gone. This is a different court, six people with very strong views on the law, very conservative views on the law, and they're not likely to be swayed by a new Biden liberal justice coming onto this court.
So we are going to talk a lot more about the makeup of the court and what the future of it could mean. But in talking about Justice Breyer himself, you talk about him as this consensus builder. I know in the courtroom during oral arguments, he is known for his professorial style, where he poses these really long, complex, hypothetical questions. Talk about those a little bit. And those are often aimed at trying to sort of nail down or narrow down what the court's position could be when an opinion comes out.
Yes, he was always an interesting person in the court because, as you say, he was sort of like a law professor and he would ask questions. They were not sort of pointed yes, no questions. They would basically say, well, here's what I'm thinking about. And then he would talk a little bit about how he viewed the case or how they viewed the issue and say, look, we could do this or we could do that. But what's the argument for why should we move this way or why should we move that way? He was sort of thinking aloud and getting the lawyers to talk. And it's appealing for a certain number of cases where they're trying to work out some reasonable position on the law. And I think he was very good at that. And it was difficult for some of the lawyers who really preferred a sort of yes, no question. But I always found him an interesting, engaging, and optimistic person, always, like, as I say, trying to find the right answer for this difficult question. And that will be missed. The court is becoming, you know this well, Kimberly, you follow it. It's become, you know, like the Senate years ago was a place where there were Republicans and Democrats, and there are a certain number of moderates who could work out deals in the middle. The Supreme Court was a little bit like that. There were moderates who would work out deals in the middle. But the court, like the Senate, and so much of is becoming more polarized with very strong views on both ends and not a lot of room in the middle.
And what do you think that Justice Breyer did? Did he try to sort of hold on to that sense that consensus could be reached? Do you think that he made a difference? Is there a place that we can point to in some of the jurisprudence where that sort of moderating effect can be seen, or is that really something of the past?
Well, I think if a fair assessment would be, if you went through the years, there were a lot of cases where he was part of a group defining a middle position. Or I remember one just from about 2 years ago. Do you remember there was a case about this large cross out in Bladensburg, Maryland? It's like a 40 or 50 foot cross in the middle of a sort of town square. And the question was, is that constitutional or is that an establishment of religion? And Breyer was part of the sort of conservative majority that said this cross is okay. But he was very insistent of saying, we're going to say it's okay because it's a 100-year-old cross that was put up to honor World War One, the people who died in World War One. It was honoring soldiers. He didn't want the court to write an opinion and say, oh, it's okay now for any city to put up a giant cross in the middle of the town square to really say we're a religious city. So in a case like that, somebody like Justice Breyer could make it, you know, the opinion was limited to saying it's okay to have a cross if it's honoring soldiers. And that's a very significant contribution. If the different areas of the law where he could shape a position where the conservative side was going to win, the cross was going to stand, but stand on the grounds that it was only because it's 100 years old and it's a military. So, and there were a lot of areas of the law where he was influential in trying to find a middle or a reasonable middle position.
And there are also areas where he was pretty vocal about how he felt, and it wasn't in the middle. It was further to the left in his opinions and dissents in cases involving, for example, abortion access and the death penalty come to mind, where he really made a mark on the court. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes. In other words, he came on the court after Roe versus Wade, after the court had upheld it in 1992. And he was always part of the sort of liberal, still liberal majority to uphold the right to abortion. And there were several cases, like you would remember the one from Texas a couple of years ago, where Texas has a law that was basically going to impose all these regulations on abortion clinics. So they had to be like mini hospitals. That was really going to shut them down and leave women for large parts of that state hundreds of miles from an abortion clinic. And Justice Breyer, with that sort of reasonable perspective, would say, well, wait a minute, what's the health benefit of this? And what's the consequence for pregnant women? And he wrote an opinion and got a majority for the view that this law had almost no health benefits for women, and it was going to hundreds of thousands of women by leaving them with no clinic anywhere near where they lived. And so that was the kind of opinion. If you looked at the evidence, he was saying we've got to block this law because the harm greatly outweighs the benefits, and therefore the law should be blocked. And as you say, on areas like the death penalty and abortion and all that, he was a very strong advocate of saying let's hold the line on the right to abortion, and let's be skeptical of certain aspects of the death penalty.
And so I know folks like you and me, David, we have been wondering since about January 20th, 2021, at about 12:01 p.m., when the timing of this retirement might be. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, he spent the last year promoting his book, but also promoting this idea that the court should not be seen as a political body. What do you think about the timing of this retirement announcement?
Well, you're absolutely right that because Justice Ginsburg died weeks before, just before the election, and her seat was filled by a younger conservative justice, there was then a lot of pressure turned to Justice Breyer to say, you should retire now rather than allowing the seat to be filled by another Republican. And his view was, I think, that, you know, last year, 2021, he could stay on the court. He would contribute something, being there were a lot of new justices, and he could be helpful and influential. But I think he knew that coming into 2022, when there's a great chance the Democrats are going to lose control of the Senate, that this was the year he had to step down. So I think most people thought he would step down this year. And he did it in an interesting way. I don't recall ever one like this, Kimberly, where right after the January, the court session in January, they basically decided, granted all the cases they were going to hear and decide this term. So he waited till they decided on all the cases they're going to hear this term, hear them in April and decide them. And then he was going to step down. And that gives the Democrats, Joe Biden and the Senate Democrats, a lot of months now to fill that seat. And they, as you know, they will move very quickly.
And we will discuss more about that. We're talking about Stephen Breyer's retirement and who his replacement might be. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking today about Justice Breyer's legacy, his potential replacements, and what that decision could mean for the future of the Supreme Court. We're joined by David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And joining us now is Jill Dash. She's Vice President of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society. Jill, it's so great to have you.
Thank you so much, Kimberly. It's wonderful to be here.
So what comes next is the confirmation process for whoever is named to succeed Justice Breyer on the court. And before we talk about exactly who that nominee might be, talk about names, let's sort of talk about the process a little bit, Jill. And the Democrats in the Senate have said that they hope to sort of match the speed with which Justice Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed last year in this. But the timing here is different. We're not coming up on an election. Why do you think the need for that speed is important?
Well, first of all, I would say there's no reason for delay. There are many candidates the president can choose from, and there's no reason to put it off. And the Senate has the time to do it over the next few months, and so they should take up their responsibility and do it. Of course, with a 50-50 Senate, it is tough to maintain that control, and anything could happen at any moment. A senator could have a family responsibility. Senator Schatz from Hawaii a couple weeks ago had COVID and was unavailable for some votes for that reason. Anything can happen, and so there's really no reason to waste time, and it is incumbent upon them to take up their duty as quickly as possible. As you said, it is different from the hearing for Justice Barrett in that that hearing took place immediately before and then at some parts during the 2020 election. People were already voting, which was part of the reason that there was some consternation around the timing for her nomination. We don't have that here, but we do have a pretty tight Senate calendar for the rest of 2022, insofar as there are also lower court nominees who are making their way through the Senate. We have to now work in a Supreme Court process, and so the Senate has a lot to do. There's no reason for delay.
And David, is there any political obstacle that you see that could stand in the way of President Biden's nominee?
Well, no. I would assume he will make the nomination, he said, at the end of February. There are 50 votes in the 50 Democratic votes. So, no, I would think unless we always say this at the time of nominations, unless something very unexpected comes up and that could cause a problem for the nominee. I think that's unlikely heading into this. And it does seem, however, that that we will not go back to the good old days when a qualified nominee would get 80, 90 or 100 votes. I guess is that most Republicans are going to be very critical of this nominee and say she's too far left or radical or whatever. They've already made noises to that effect. But in the end, I would assume that politically, the Democrats have 50 votes and Kamala Harris to see to it that she's approved. And Judge Jackson got three Republican votes for the appeals court last year. So that would suggest that those three Republicans would be leaning in favor of supporting her nomination as well, if she's indeed the nominee.
And Jill, President Biden said yesterday that he will seek the advice and consent of the Senate, also talking to members of both parties about who the nominee might be. This is different than what we saw in the previous administration with those three nominations. That process was really left to outside groups like the Federalist Society to come up with a list of names that President Trump talked about even before he was elected. We don't see that same sort of approach being taken in this administration, despite the fact that your organization is often seen as the counter to the Federalist Society. Explain that difference.
Well, I think what you see in Republican administrations is they lean very heavily on these outside groups because everybody shares the same ideology, and they really move in lockstep. On the left, there's tend to be a lot more considerations. It's a lot more of a heterogeneous group of people. And I also think this White House takes their duties very seriously. They will get input from lots of different groups, including the American Constitution Society. Of course, we have worked with the White House on lower court nominations and will be very busy working on the Supreme Court vacancy. But there's lots of groups that have interests here, and I think the White House will care about that. I also think they are obligated under the Constitution to seek the advice and consent of the Senate and really take that into consideration. We did hear during the Trump administration, then White House counsel Don McGahn saying that he doesn't outsource to the Federalist Society. He is of the Federalist Society, so he was insourcing. And it doesn't leave a lot of room for different ideas at that point. But they also used it as a campaign tactic because everybody wanted to know that President Trump would pick the kind of judges that they expected on the right. Democrats haven't used that as a campaign tactic, although I do think that progressives have generally gotten much more interested in all of the courts. And I think that that's a very healthy thing to realize that the courts are an important part of our democracy.
So let's talk about how this process may play out. Linda Greenhouse is a lecturer and senior research scholar at Yale Law School. She says that whoever President Biden's nominee may be, the Supreme Court they'll be walking into has experienced a major shift since Justice Amy Coney Barrett took over the seat previously occupied by Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I think the court is in a very institutionally dangerous position right now, because its center of gravity is far to the right of the American public. What we're seeing now is the court injecting itself in these culture war issues, where the court is taking for itself the ability to have the last word.
Greenhouse says the 2020-2021 term saw the court taking up several cases that exemplified this shift.
In the past, there was not a solid majority for revisiting Roe versus Wade. There was not a solid majority for expanding the right to own a gun that the court established in the 2008 case, Heller. And now all of a sudden we have supermajority, and they are really feeling their oats. And so they go back into the abortion issue, which was an astonishingly activist thing to do.
The outcomes of these major cases are yet to be determined, but with the 6-3 conservative majority, it's unlikely the new nominee will be able to change the course of events. But Greenhouse says this selection will give Democrats an opportunity to play a long game.
This will be a person, let's assume, a generation younger. Justice Breyer is 83, and the Republicans have played a long game in naming quite young people to the court. And, you know, this vacancy now gives the Democrats a chance to play a tiny bit of the same long game.
Linda Greenhouse, law lecturer and senior research scholar at Yale Law School. She's the author of Justice on the Brink, The Death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, The Rise of Amy Coney Barrett, and 12 Months That Transformed the Supreme Court. So, David, we don't yet know who the nominees are, right? We're about to talk about some possibilities. But talk a little bit about what Linda said about the impact of this new justice on the court, a court that has been made not only more conservative, but a lot younger by the previous administration. Today, actually, is Amy Coney Barrett's 50th birthday. That's quite young for a justice.
Yes. So I agree with Linda's assessment about where we are now. And I think it would be interesting is if the new justice proves to be sort of a strong liberal voice that kind of speak out in dissent. We haven't had someone like that on the court since Justice Brennan and Thurgood Marshall retired 30 years ago. To some degree, Sonia Sotomayor dissents in some cases. Elena Kagan is a very smart, shrewd, writes good, but they have not been sort of consistent, full-throated dissents. I'm thinking of the way Justice Scalia used to lose a lot of big cases, but he was such a powerful speaker and a powerful voice. His views sort of echoed and became the sort of Republican conservative view around the country. And I think it'd be very interesting if the new justice knows that she's not going to probably be able to change much about what the conservatives want to do on abortion or guns or religion or a whole series of other areas. But she can be a very powerful voice to say, here's what's wrong with the way this court is doing. We believe in the separation of church and state and equal rights for voters and whatnot. And so I'll be interested to see if the new justice can sort of play the role of a sort of voice of dissent or disagreement with the direction of a court that's going to be moving right for a very long time.
And Jill, we keep saying she because the president has vowed since the campaign trail to appoint a Black woman to the Supreme Court should a vacancy arise. A few names have sort of come to the fore of the public discussion. One is Ketanji Brown Jackson. She is on the D.C. Circuit where she's been since last year. Among the interesting tidbits about her is that she is related by marriage to former House Speaker Paul Ryan, who gave a glowing recommendation for her when she was nominated for the D.C. Circuit. There's also Leandra Kruger, who has argued before the court many times. She's now on the California Supreme Court. And there's Michelle Childs, who is on the District Court in South Carolina. She is the favorite pick of Congressman James Clyburn, who is very close to Biden and has said that this was an important campaign issue for him. So, Jill, this idea that it's important to appoint a Black woman that has been met with some criticism, people saying that this is just identity politics. Others say it's important to have that diversity of lived experience. Talk a little bit about how this will be historic.
It will be historic. It was historic even when the president made that pledge. And he didn't just make that pledge out of thin air. It was a recognition that the Supreme Court has lacked representation of the American people, and in particular has never had a Black woman. This next justice would be only the sixth woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court in a nearly 250-year history. For the people who are calling this identity politics, it's because they're used to identifying white men on the Supreme Court, 108 of them. That's what the Supreme Court looks like to a whole lot of people. But to many Americans, the Supreme Court looks nothing like them, but then rules on issues that affects their lives day in and day out. And so I think the president was recognizing that the Supreme Court should look like America, or at least a little bit more like America, and is vowing to do something about that. I will also say this White House didn't just make that pledge and leave it there. They've steadily built up the farm team over the last year in their lower court nominations, bringing many more diverse nominees to the federal courts. And so it's really been a commitment from this White House.
And David, how might that play out in the confirmation process? I mean, you and I both recall during the confirmation of Justice Sonia Sotomayor, for example, a comment that she had made about being a wise Latina and how that could impact the way she makes decisions became very controversial very quickly. Does that look different today? And might we see that same sort of dynamic play out?
I guess is that we might see that dynamic play out, Kimberly. The my guess is that this is going to be a very good nominee, and as I say, a nominee who's destined to be confirmed. But the confirmations are always sort of a minefield. That and all the nominees will tell you that after. I've been surprised how many of them seem sort of like shell shocked, even a year after their confirmation, that they feel like they could say anything and it'll blow up. And yes, on the areas of race and ethnicity or whatever, it is true that almost anything the nominee says or writes on that subject could trigger some controversy or some backlash or somehow. But I don't think it will turn out to be other than sort of one of these talking points for 48 hours or whatever, a way to criticize the nominee, but nothing that will have any longer lasting impact.
And Jill, might there be a dark horse candidate who emerges? I mean, even Stephen Breyer, when he was nominated, it was a year after he was first interviewed by President Clinton about another vacancy. And it turned out that even though he was close to the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Ted Kennedy, at the time, Ruth Bader Ginsburg came in and really dazzled the president and became that pick before he did. Breyer got the nod a year later. Might we see something like that happen despite the fact that we have this list of frontrunners?
Of course, it's possible. And none of us has a crystal ball and we don't know where we'll end up. But the president does have a lot of choices. There are many fabulously accomplished Black women across the country. There are some Black women on other state courts aside from Leandra Krueger. He could be looking there. Many people have mentioned Sherrilyn Ifill as a nonprofit leader. That is a sector where the president could be looking for people. There are law professors who are Black women, many of whom would make wonderful Supreme Court justices. So it's not just a matter of looking at the federal courts as they are now. There is, of course, no requirement in the Constitution for the particular background of a Supreme Court justice. And so the president could consider a much broader group of candidates. And I think it's actually a very fun time to think about all of the possibilities of potential Supreme Court justices.
And talk a little bit more about that. I mean, right now, only one justice was not previously a federal judge. That's Elena Kagan. There used to be, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor was a legislator at one point. Talk about the diversity of experience.
I think the diversity of experience matters. One thing that we've seen on lower court nominations is the White House has really looked at civil rights lawyers, public defenders, people we don't normally see on the federal bench. There's no reason why we wouldn't also bring that diversity of experience to the Supreme Court as well.
All right. We are discussing Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement, his potential replacements, and what that decision could mean for the Supreme Court. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Next week, we're going to be talking about vaccine requirements. And we really want to hear from you. Every city, state, and country are all doing something different. And the real question we want to explore is, do these requirements even work? What's been your experience? Have vaccines been required in your area to enter a restaurant or a bar, to go to work? The list goes on and on. More importantly, have these requirements made you feel safer? Have you been dining with friends, reassured that everyone around you was vaccinated? And even, did they persuade you to get vaccinated when you weren't sure you wanted to be? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about Justice Stephen Breyer's legacy, the state of the Supreme Court, and the impact his replacement could have. We're joined by Los Angeles Times Supreme Court reporter David Savage, and also by Jill Dash, Vice President of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society. So Jill, talk a little more. We've talked about the fact that this is a 6-3 court and that the new appointee will not change that. But talk about the ways in which the new justice could make a difference. I mean, it's much more than what the opinions turn out to be. It's decisions like how they choose cases and how they are decided. What do you expect that impact to be, Jill?
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about representation, and I do think that bringing this diversity of thought, diversity of lived experience to the court will make a difference. I think in terms of judicial philosophy, it will bring an additional perspective to the court. You know, it's interesting. David referred earlier to the idea of having a strong liberal dissenter, and there certainly is a value to that. And I think every time a case is decided, any judge who sits on a panel has to decide, do they want to speak about what the law ought to be in their view and be the dissenter, or do they try to make some compromise the way we've spoken about Justice Breyer doing? Can the problem be solved in some way that everyone can walk away with something? I think for every case, judges have to make that decision. Are you going to compromise or are you going to discuss your view of the law in putting ideas forward that should be taken up in the future? I think this new justice will have to decide how to strike that balance. And I'm very attracted to the idea of somebody who, you know, comes in, if they're going to be the voice of dissent, talking about what the law ought to look like so that the American people can understand where that person is coming from. We know this person is very likely to be very often in the dissent. So how do you use that platform to talk to the American people about where the law is headed and what it can do to improve their lives?
And David, it's not just dissenting opinions that serve as that kind of platform, but also in oral arguments. I mean, it was very often that Justice Breyer, for example, would go back and forth with Justice Scalia in a way that, you know, was not only very entertaining at times, but really sort of pushed each other on what their opinions were. You can kind of see that that tug of war between the more conservative parts of the bench and the liberal parts of it, of the bench happening in front of you. Is that something that this new justice is going to have to do? Is that a role she'll have to fill?
Yes, it's a very important role. And I agree with the way Jill phrased it, too. It'd be very interesting if the new justice during her confirmation hearings sort of sets out her view of the law and the Constitution and things like equal rights and equal rights for voters, decent treatment for there've been so much over the last few years about horrible treatment of African Americans by the police. If a justice says those are the kind of things I really care about, and then you see cases in the courtroom, it's very important for a justice who's got a different. They get a lot of pro-government, pro-prosecution cases. Judge spent some time as a public defender, that gives you a little sort of sensitivity of the views from the other side. And so, yes, I think she could be very influential in both in the court's internal deliberations and in the public arguments of sort of raising issues or raising concerns that sort of causes you to view a case or view an issue differently.
And David, you're mentioning the confirmation hearings themselves. In recent years, do we really learn that much from a nominee? It seems that nominees are very much disincentivized to say anything other than, I can't possibly comment on a case or an issue that may come before the court. That would be improper. Do you expect something different out of this confirmation process?
Well, yours is a fair and accurate criticism. That is, the confirmation hearings are usually disappointing, that the nominee knows that the only way I can get into trouble is talking and saying much. And so the safe course is to say very little and say, Senator, I will just follow the law and whatever the law tells me, that's what I'll do. But I think it is possible that some of the justices, some of the nominees sort of say things. You get a sense of what they care about in the law and what they think about the law. So I'm hoping there's at least some chance to see who this nominee is and what she believes. But you're absolutely right to say we shouldn't overpromise of learning a whole lot in the confirmation hearings.
And Jill, there will be a lot of big blockbuster cases awaiting the new justice. We've already talked about the speed with which the court has moved forward with reexamining its precedent on everything from guns and the Second Amendment to abortion access and Roe v. Wade. Coming up next term already, we have an affirmative action challenge. We have another challenge involving the EPA and the ability of the Biden administration to impose rules there. Very likely we'll have voting challenges. Talk about the substantively what lies ahead for this court and the time we are right now.
Well, I would say apropos of what Linda Greenhouse was saying earlier, this is a court that has become completely unafraid to weigh into the thorniest social issues of the day. Even when, as with abortion, precedent is fairly firmly established. And so it is increasingly what we would normally call a pretty activist court. Conservatives like to talk about judicial restraint, but we're certainly not seeing that from this Supreme Court. And so this new justice, no doubt, will be thrown into the middle of that. And then, as we mentioned, we'll have to decide, are you a dissenter who talks about what this all looks like from your new perch on the Supreme Court bench? Is there a way that you try to stem the tide of this very conservative lurch to the right? time will tell. It's very interesting that during the most recent oral arguments on abortion at the Supreme Court, Justice Sonia Sotomayor just almost somewhat casually started talking about the stench that this set of cases will leave on the court because people see it becoming so political. And immediately that terminology got picked up and carried forward. And now it's become common parlance to talk about the stench of this rightward lurch of the Supreme Court. And so that's what the new justice will find herself in the middle of.
And David, talk about how this could impact the personal dynamics of the court. I mean, there was a little controversy about whether masking became a problem between the justices at the Supreme Court. But we also know that on the court, there are justices that have forged friendships, some unlikely, like Justices Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who were probably at the polar opposites ideologically. And also Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch are very close. How does that affect how the court works and what might this new justice mean for a change in those dynamics?
You know, it's always hard to know, Kimberly, because you're absolutely right, is that to their great credit is they know there are nine of them. They're going to meet and talk behind closed doors, and they're going to do it this year and next year and the year after. And they're very committed to the idea that we are friends and colleagues, and we have to talk and debate and respect the views of the others. And I think they do that. This is not a court, you know, if you talk to none of the justices have anything bad to say about their colleagues. They are they like each other. They get along. They actually see each other sometimes outside the court. And I assume the new justice will be part of that, will be welcomed in, and will become a friendly colleague. On the other hand, they are lawyers and judges, and they really do have very different views about the law. And it'll be very interesting. It's never clear whether the personal relationship translates much into decisions or whatever where they agree with each other. I think in the case of Justice Breyer, he actually went out of his way to have a good relationship with Justice Kennedy, for example. Most people wouldn't know that. They both grew up in Northern California at the same time. Breyer was from San Francisco. Kennedy was from Sacramento. They both went to Stanford. They actually had a lot in common. And some of those cases, 5 years ago, we talked about the abortion case from Texas. Kennedy and Breyer could work together because they knew each other, they respected each other, and they were friends. And so we will not know down the road, but sometimes I think a justice can develop a friendship and a respect for each other. And who knows, down the road, it can be very important on some big issue that we may not even know what that issue is yet.
And Jill, let's talk a little bit about the public perception of the court. For a long time, the public perception of the elected branches of government had been fairly low, but we've seen in recent years the approval ratings of the court itself drop as more Americans express a view that it is too just a political body. Do you think that that could change, that the new nominee could make a difference when it comes to that? We saw Justice Breyer spending a great deal of time over the last year really trying to make the case to the American people that they need to believe in the court, that they need to believe that it is not just a partisan body in order for democracy to be protected. Do you think that's possible?
I think it's really tough. I appreciate Justice Breyer's optimism. But this really is a court that is significantly far to the right of the American people and is not showing a respect for precedent. They're revisiting all kinds of issues that we thought were settled and not necessarily to the betterment of the average American. In many ways, I think they've earned that reputation that is sliding downward. And I don't know what one new justice who is going to be in the more likely progressive minority is going to do about that. I will say, I hope that this renewed focus on the Supreme Court has folks thinking about where it's headed and what we're going to do about it. I don't think anybody particularly enjoys this sense that people are losing respect for the Supreme Court. And the question is, what is there to do about that? You're not going to immediately overnight change the minds of the six more conservative justices. Is there something that should be done to change the structure of the Supreme Court? Should we be adding seats to address the fact that Merrick Garland never got a hearing and that seat was basically stolen from the Obama administration, or the fact that Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation was jammed in at a time when people were already voting? Those things were discussed at length and feel almost trite at this point, but it still does amount in two seats that were essentially stolen from more progressive picks. So what do we do about that? Or how do we think about the court going forward? How do we get them to reform their thoughts? I don't see one justice changing that dynamic, but I do hope it lifts up the conversation around what the Supreme Court ought to look like and how they ought to operate.
David, do you think that the issue of potential reforms to the Supreme Court may come up again in the process of this confirmation? I mean, we know that the president had a commission to examine potential ways to reform the court, and they really didn't come to a decision. They sort of laid out some options, and it kind of fizzled from there, and there wasn't any action expected. Might this confirmation process re-energize that discussion?
Well, Kimberly, my sense is that what's going to energize it is what Jill referred to a minute ago. In other words, this might be talked about at the confirmation hearing, but what I think would energize it is, suppose we get to June and there's a Roe versus Wade is overturned and the court says no right to abortion. There is a right to carry a gun in public, even, you know, on Fifth Avenue in New York. And they have a serious decisions. They have a case on climate change where the conservatives could basically say the government can't, EPA can't do anything about climate change. And so there's a series of rulings like that. And there's no liberal or moderate liberal wins, which there had been for last 20 years. Then I think the talk about changing the court or reforming the court or whatever it is going to come back. That is, if the public thinks, wow, this really is a lockstep court that goes very far to the right in a lot of big areas, then I think this will be a topic of conversation again.
Jill, do you agree with that?
I do. And I think no one should underestimate the amount of energy and excitement around both the opportunity to put a new justice on the Supreme Court, particularly when we have this commitment to name a Black woman. A lot of women are energized. A lot of people in Black communities and other minority communities are super energized about this. And people will also be energized around thinking about the Supreme Court if it really shows itself to be out of pace with the American people's thinking.
Jill Dash is Vice President of Strategic Engagement at ACS. Jill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Savage is Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. It was great to talk to you, David.
Good to talk with you again, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.